Time now for Labor Press, your source for daily labor news and industry information. Hear discussions on the workplace and interesting talk from prominent and influential personalities in the labor community. And now your hosts, Neil Tippel and Bill Holfeld.
Accountability. Good evening and welcome to Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz right here at AM 970 The Answer. My name is Bill Holfeld. I'm your host this evening, and in the studio with me is my co-host and producer, Joe Maniscalco. Joe, how are we doing today?
Bill, what is this Blue Collar Buzz? Tell the people what it is.
Oh, you want me to get specific. Okay, Blue Collar Buzz. Blue Collar Buzz, that's the program where we talk about everyday workers, their jobs, their struggles, and hopefully their victories. Thank you, Joe. Anyway, so Joe, I know you're a Brooklynite, yes?
I am indeed.
You're born and raised in Brooklyn.
Born and raised.
And very important part of Brooklyn in terms of a healthcare facility is Maimonides Hospital, is it not?
Maimonides is a giant institution in Brooklyn, and sadly, they recently made the announcement that they want to axe 117 workers before Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
And when I spoke to them, they put the number as high as 200.
Well, Joe, how can you get rid of 117 people? I mean, that's an awful lot of, I mean, what are they going to do? Put in robots? I mean, how are they doing this? I mean, well, I'm talking patient care here.
It's called short staffing. And of course, the burden falls on the workers that remain. And, you know, they're arguing fiercely that it can't be done. And 1199 SEIU, which represents the workers there, has actually introduced a 10-point plan that they said that they're bringing to the hospital administrators and saying, hey, instead of doing these layoffs, these firings, these are 10 things you can do to save money and you won't have to fire anyone.
All right. So they're trying to be creative and proactive, and they're coming not with just complaints. They're coming to the table with possible solutions to the problem.
Right. And Steve Kramer from 1199 talked about that plan at a lunchtime rally a couple of days ago. And I think we have that tape right now.
Okay, cool.
But I just want to say one thing before introducing Vice President Corman Eda Moore. By the way, the press is here. Thank 1199 for getting the press here today. Yes. Thank the press for being here today. Yes. To report this evil act.
Yes.
Many times people who are not evil people commit evil acts.
That's right.
That unfortunately is what's happening here in Maimonides.
That's right.
I don't say Ken Gibbs is an evil person, but unfortunately, he never discussed this layoff. They never had a job freeze. They never had an overtime freeze. They did nothing to contact 1199 and say, what can you do to get extra funds from Maimonides? They did nothing but drive themselves into the hole, mismanage whatever else they did wrong. They didn't do anything to make this place run the way it's supposed to run. You know it. I know it. Everybody knows it. So we put together a 10-point plan that we think can turn this around. And I'll tell you the conversation I had with Ken Gibbs, the first Vice President Moore. Let's give him a good hand, everybody.
Good afternoon, sisters and brothers. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for coming. When you go back to work, we expect that you tell your coworkers to come out.
Woo.
To come out for the rest of the lunch period. It's important that we get this communication going effectively to make sure that people are not confused about what's going on.
Okay.
As Steve Kramer just informed you, our notice was 2 days before they gave out the 30-day notice. That is totally inappropriate. It's unacceptable. It's outrageous.
Yeah.
It's almost leveling on the criminal act to do that before the holidays.
Yeah.
But there have been no attempt to do anything to prevent this. Yeah. Nothing. We are asking you to come out on a regular basis to fight this layoff, to stop this layoff until something is done that makes sense. This makes no sense.
Yes.
Totally inappropriate. We put together a 10-point plan. As Steve said, I'd like to just go over it. Did everybody get a copy?
Yes.
This is going to be our plan. And some more suggestions from you. We're looking for all suggestions. Postpone all layoffs until February 15th with the goal of no layoffs.
Yes!
Yes! Administration and the union should set up a joint stop the layoff emergency council.
Yes!
Immediate total job freeze.
Yes!
Immediate overtime freeze.
Yes!
The unions and management go to the governor and the New York State legislature for immediate assistance to get through this crisis.
Yes!
The union and management go to the mayor and the New York City Council for emergency assistance.
Yes!
Northwell, help lend my money's funds to get through this crisis.
Yes!
My money's employees making over $150,000 can reduce their salary for a period of time.
Yes!
This crisis. The union's hospital financial expert analyzed all my money's financial records and make recommendations for stability.
Yes!
Additional ideas, as I said, from you are important, and we can stop this layoff, and we will do it with your help.
Yes! Yes!
So our message, the only thing we want to say right now, as we go through the institution, as we go talk to our managers, is stop the layoff.
Stop the layoff!
Well, I gotta tell you, Joe, you know, here's the first thing that comes to my mind. This is just the way my warped mind works, okay? You know that this has to be bad management, and the proof that it's bad management is because anybody with a half a brain, just from a PR standpoint, would never lay off 117 people before Christmas. You would wait till like January 2nd to send the notices out. I mean, I'm not even talking about being a nice person. I'm just talking about being a smart person. So that's an indicator of how badly they think things out.
Well, the person, Ken Gibbs, that Steve Kramer was referencing is the head of the hospital, CEO of the hospital. Yeah, and his name might as well be Ebenezer Scrooge. The notice came so quickly and so out of the blue that the union didn't even have time to file for a picketing permit from the cops. And, you know, they need 10 days in order to do that. So they had this little rally out there, and they always got in trouble with the cops who, you know, were looking to bust things up. I think right now we're going to hear from a couple of workers themselves, and they're going to talk about what this layoff means to them and what life is like working at Maimonides today.
Okay.
It is going to affect all of us, not only me, but it affects all of us because we have rent, we have mortgages to pay, we have children to support. So, yes, it affects all of us.
What do you do, Gospel?
I'm an orderly. I'm a transporter. I transport patients from one exam to the next. I work for ECHO.
And how long have you been with the hospital?
15 years.
15 years. And when did you hear about these layoffs?
We just heard about it. Like, I think it was yesterday or the day before yesterday. They called us to the auditorium. And we had a meeting. And that's when they started telling us. They didn't tell us. They didn't warn us. We just heard rumors and people getting laid off. 115 people got laid off. And that's when we all started realizing that they were not playing.
So the hospital says that the reason for those layoffs are because of dwindling federal reimbursements and other costs. What do you say to that?
This is what they're saying. I think it's a lie. I think it's all a lie because even our people from our union, our delegates, didn't even know about all this meeting. And when Pam Blair was here, she would call a meeting and they would do the freeze on first and then lay off maybe one or two people and cut off the overtime. No, they laid off 115 people that have family, they have children that are in the need. And right before the holidays also, it was not fair for them. So we are all in jeopardy of our job because we don't know if we are safe, if we gotta have a job for tomorrow.
So there you have it, Bill. So not only are more than over 100 people axed before the holidays, but you have everybody else who's still on staff working in fear, not knowing whether they're going to be next.
You know, and that would make me so angry. When I was listening, to the way she described the way they called them all into the auditorium and all and told them, well, we're going to get rid of 115 or 117 of you. You know, my initial reaction would be, okay, you don't need 115 of us? fine, we'll leave now. And I mean, that would be the kind of anger that would spur in me. That, and you know, years ago, workers did do that. They just walked out.
Well, again, these Maimonides Hospital workers, they all care about their work. They
good
really
point,
take
Joe.
A lot of care about caring for the community. I mean, one of the people I spoke to that has been on the job for 30 years.
Wow. How much does the CEO of this hospital make?
He makes over $150,000 a year.
Okay, well, maybe we should start with him if we
Ken
need budget
Gibbs.
Cuts. Yeah.
Ken, maybe you want to, you know, pony up a little bit.
Ken, think about it. Okay, where do you see this going real quick, Joe, before we go to break? Where do you see this going?
Well, right now, Bill, everything is percolating. Everything is up in the air at this point.
Well, we're gonna wish him well for now, but it's just, you know, boy, you talk about Ebenezer Scrooge, he's alive and well. We'll talk about it a bit more later, but right now we got to go to a break, so we will be back in just a second with some more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer. Welcome back to Labor Press, the show about labor and the laborer. Here are your hosts, Neil Tappell and Bill Holfeld.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer. I'm your host, Bill Holfeld. And in the studio with me is my co-host and partner and producer, Joe Maniscalco. Joe, that really, you know, just for one second here, that was really horrible. That was really horrible what happened at that hospital. I mean, to lose your job like that right before Christmas, that's heartless, especially if you have a plan like that, that you want to say, listen, let's sit down, let's talk, we can work this out.
Well, exactly. Like you said, it's just incredible. Just the way it was done unilaterally, the timing of it, the way it was handled, I mean, forget about the fact that you came to the decision that this is what you have to do in order to sustain the hospital. But the way you rolled it out, it just shows your callousness and, you know.
I got. Well, let's wish him the best. But, you know, I know we got to move on here. Now, I know that there's the hospitals aren't the only part of the city that are facing a challenge right now. I know the adjunct staff over at CUNY are looking at down at some hard times right now.
Yeah,
is that right?
All the instructors represented by the Professional Staff Congress are fighting for another contract. It seems like only yesterday that they capped off their multi-year, 5-6 year fight for the last contract. Now they're fighting for a new one. The main thing, one of the main parts of this is that they want to get the adjunct professors up to 7K for a course. Overall, the union is arguing that the government is not investing in the system, a system that, you know, so many New Yorkers rely on to, you know, start their lives over again and start their lives out fresh.
Well, you know, Joe, it's really funny. Teachers are one of those people that recently in society that people feel comfortable taking a shot at. Of course, most of the people who take a shot at teachers are people who have never gotten up and taught a course in their life. And if you're dedicated to that job and you care about your job and you're trying to do that job properly, people have no idea how much hard work that is.
They don't understand the amount of preparation, the amount of out of office, out of classroom work that goes into it. But we have Professor Frances Fox Piven, who was at a demonstration just the other day, and I think she lays it out pretty well, and we're going to hear from her right now.
Okay.
Not only a professor inside, but a leader outside, and a long, long time leader of the Poor People's Campaign. And she has worked for decades to support the very people we teach, not only here in New York, but to support that population nationally. And we are very proud to have among our ranks the kind of distinguished scholar who is here today, who leads a next generation of students. Some of her students are right here with us. We are very proud to be joined by Professor Frances Fox Piven.
It's a very strange time in American politics, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's hard to take your eyes off the television set or off your computer screen, where you're hearing about bizarre, crazy plots with foreign countries. at the same time as they're planning to actually steal money from the pockets of working and poor families in order to reward the corporate biggies. Well, that's going on, and we're transfixed by it and by the clown who is kind of the insignia of a crazed Republican Party that is in power in all three branches of government. But, you know, we're going to get over this because we're going to fight back.
Yes, that's right.
And we're going to fight back drawing strength from our local institutions.
That's right.
And we're going to draw strength especially from our universities and our public universities.
Yes.
You know, the United States is losing standing in every which way,
yes.
Militarily, financially, in its productivity. But there's one institution in the United States of which we can still be proud and which the world admires. That's our universities,
yes.
And
yeah.
Especially our public universities.
Yes.
But those universities are also under assault, as CUNY is under assault. We, you know, this university has been here forever, and it's grown bigger and gotten better. But it's under constant pressure, the pressure of austerity politics.
Right.
At the heart of any good university are the faculty and the students and the intellectual environment that they create, an environment of smartness, dissent, erudition, argument, and democracy.
That's right.
But we can't have that kind of faculty and students and that kind of intellectual culture unless we fight back against the cutbacks that have given us part-time faculty who are under the heel of administrators and politicians and who don't earn enough to live on. And that's why an organized faculty to protect the institution, the students, and our adjunct faculty are so important, and it's why I'm so proud of our professional staff in Congress. We have a union to lead us in this fight,
yeah.
And we have students and faculty who are behind their union.
So that's the game plan, to cut back so much that the institution has to hire more part-time instructors, adjuncts. And, of course, you can pay those adjunct professors less, and that's what's happening here. The union made tremendous strides with the last contract over what was, but they argued that they're still way behind.
Yeah, well, we're in a period now, as Ms. Piven just pointed out. We're in that rollback period. I mean, we see what's going on, and it is, unfortunately, it is partisan right now. We see what the Republicans are doing with the tax reform bill, and it's not a tax reform bill. It's a tax theft bill, right? They're going to steal our money and give it to rich people.
Robber barons.
Exactly. So we see we're in that economy now, and we're in that. And we're in that environment now, that political environment now, and they're going to get away with as much as they can while they can. And it's sad, but it's true because somehow, again, just like I was talking about how teachers get a bad rap, anything, quote unquote, public gets a bad rap. Somehow we got to this place in this country where we think anything private is better than anything public. And that's never been true and that never will be true.
Well, I think all of that, of course, is right on the money, Bill. In our next clip, we're going to hear from Barbara Bowen. She's the head of the Professional Staff Congress. And she's going to talk about how the union now is positioning itself, coming off the last six-year fight to get a contract and what they can expect going into this new round of negotiations.
Barbara, can you talk a little bit about the last contract and how that set you up going for this one?
Yes, the question was about the last contract and how it set us up going for this one. Lots of you were with us, and lots of you were with us. The last contract took 6 years to settle. 6 years. That's because CUNY didn't put any money on the table for 5 years. That contract made some significant advances. It raised salaries. It kept even with inflation. It made some really big gains for professional staff, for job security, for adjuncts. But it has not restored our salaries to a competitive level. And when the salaries at Columbia, Rutgers, Pace, Fordham, Stony Brook are $30,000 or more higher for a professor, people who teach at CUNY are often finding it hard to stay. So we're trying to recover some of the lost ground in salaries and get decent pay for people who do extraordinary work.
So I think that pretty much encapsulates what the situation is. The adjuncts, they're just looking to keep their head above water, trying to, you know, make enough to make ends meet. And the full-tenure professors, you know, they're trying to get a competitive salary so that they don't see their colleagues back up and
go
wherever.
Yeah, they'd like to have something called parity, which is what anybody in any workplace, whatever it is you do for a living, you know, one of the main sources of dissatisfaction among workers is when they think that they're not being paid fairly. And one of the ways they judge whether or not they're being paid fairly is what their colleagues are earning. So which is why people hate unions, why management hates unions, because when you have a union shop, you know what everybody is making because there's a contract, and they would much rather you didn't know what anybody is making.
Well, because then it's easier to divide and conquer.
Exactly. You know, so I guess we're clear on our politics, Joe. So, you know, well, we can only wish them well. But, you know.
Well,
but,
we're going to continue following the story, of course.
Yeah, their problem is, you know what, taxpayers always feel overburdened. So public workers are always in that double bind where, yeah, they deserve what's coming to them. But it's hard to put another burden on a taxpayer, so the money's got to come from somewhere.
I think we're going to be lucky enough to get Barbara Bowen on a show in the next coming weeks, and I just want to remind everybody to follow us on Twitter at Labor Press NY, write to us at bcb@laborpress.org, go to our website for daily news at laborpress.org, and find us on Facebook.
Well, thanks a lot, Joe. And with that, we're going to take a little break, and we will be back in just a few moments with more good talk. Right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer. Welcome back to Labor Press, the show about labor and the laborer. Here are your hosts, Neil Tappel and Bill Holfeld.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970 The Answer. I'm your host, Bill Holfeld. In the studio with me is my colleague and friend and partner, Joe Maniscalco. Well, you know, Joe, what we try to do here, as you know, is we try to stay pretty diverse. And this program is very diverse in the sense that we had hospital workers on, and we talked about university professors. And now we're going to move over to the building trades. Am I right?
And to plumbers.
Okay.
And a very special plumber indeed by the name of Judalyn Cassidy. She's a Local One plumber, and she's also a mentor. And she has a program called Tools and Tiaras. I interviewed her a little while ago. We're going to hear from her right now. She's going to talk about that and talk about all the great things she's doing to bolster the union movement.
Yeah, let's hear about that.
We first met at the 35th anniversary of Women Firefighters in the NYC. And so talked with a lot of passion about being a plumber and why you love the job so much. So let's start off with that and just talk about the job and why you think it's such a great vocation for you.
Man, I love being a plumber. I wake up every day still excited to go to the job, except when it's really cold. But just the fact that I get to work with my hands and to be part of a community that I helped build America is just so important to me. And it also works with, like, things in my brain, the way my brain works. I love solving puzzles. Mm. And plumbing is always a puzzle, where the line goes, make sure I don't hit the ducts, make sure I'm not in the way for the electrician. So it's a continuous motion of always keeping your brain active, of having to look at the blueprints. So for me, that is exciting. And I just know that being a plumber is a calling for me. Like, it's very difficult for me to walk away from it right now.
Well, how did you get started?
I actually wanted, like I said, I grew up in Trinidad and Tobago, and I wanted to be a lawyer. I've dreamed about being a lawyer, and when my grandmother passed, my great-grandmother passed away, who I grew up with, and she passed away, I had no means of going to university. That's how it is in Trinidad. To pay for the pay for university, and the trades was a free education. So I was one of the first three girls to be allowed to do plumbing at the John Donaldson Technical Institute. And they didn't want to accept me in at first, but I proved that I wanted to do it. And that's how I kind of started with plumbing. And then I moved to America, and I didn't do plumbing for a long time because I was a babysitter, I was a nanny, all of that before I actually started back working with my tools. Mm-hmm.
So talk about your experience now. You're involved in a ton of interesting projects. One of the most interesting is that you are on the advisory committee of the soon-to-be-constructed Women's Building of New York City. Talk about that.
Oh, that building is absolutely amazing. The Women's Building was once a Bayview Correctional Facility, and it was one of the worst prisons for women in the United States of America. And it was shut down because of a flood of, I love to say it was a place that brought pain for women, and then it was shut down by a woman named Sandy. Mm-hmm. So it shut down, and now it's being rebuilt and reborn into a place where women and girls from all over the world can come and fight for equal justice for women in whatever field they work in. And the great thing about that is the Nouveau Foundation is, could have built it non-union, but they are building it union so that a lot of tradeswomen could be on that job.
Do you have any idea as far as numbers, how many involved?
Well, they're shooting for like about 35% women on the job right now, and we're hoping to exceed that goal as everything that we try to do as women. But I think it's a test pilot to show in this city that you can build a building like that union and also make it equitable work-wise for men and women. Mm.
Tell me about Tools and Tiaras.
So Tools and Tiaras is a nonprofit that I started because I'm passionate about teaching. So I'm like the mechanic on the job that love having apprentices and teaching them. And Tools and Tiaras is my way of giving back. And I feel like if more young girls pick up tools, we can change the percentage of women in construction, which has been 3% since 1970. That is not good. And I think being in the trades could change so many women's lives and so many young girls, and also just help build this country because union built this country. So I really, I'm passionate about it. So once a month, I have workshops where I teach girls plumbing, electrical, carpentry. And at first, they're really intimidated. And by the end, they want to take my job as being a plumber. I just had a class last Saturday with the Girl Scouts. And it brought joy to my heart that the girls said that this was one of the best classes they ever had. So the need is there. People don't know that they need it, but we have to show them that there's other possibilities instead of going into college debt, that this is a viable option. Mm-hmm. And our country is falling apart, our infrastructure, and we need tradespeople. And women are available mm-hmm. and want to do it.
That said, though, there's still not a lot of female plumbers out there, but you have actually started a new women's committee but with the union. It's called the Croton Sisters?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So the Croton Sisters, we started meeting for like about a year, not in our union, at the public libraries, coffee shop, because we wanted to encourage more women to come into the union, and also we wanted to keep what we have. So what was happening, a lot of women would come in and then they would leave for various reasons, you know, the job site, the way they were treated or the lack of opportunity. So this is a way of like letting them see that the union could be a viable career, that you can stay only because it's different for men and women, and we have to be obvious like that. Men have a natural built-in mentoring program with each other. Men naturally mentor each other. Hey, kid, I'll show you how to do this. But with a woman, it's a little bit different. So that way we're able to mentor them and teach them skills, not just plumbing skills, that can enable them to stay in the trades.
Right. Well, talk more about that. Expand on, you know, I know that you love your job, but there are challenges on the job, you know, for women. Talk about that and talk about the role that the union plays in that.
Yeah, I think just like any relationship, the unions, we can do a better job of making it accessible and also viable and a long-term career for women. Every relationship, and that's one of the things that we have to work on as a union, how we can get these group of people who are there already not to leave, because the baby boomers are retiring, and when they leave, there's no people to take those jobs. And you already have somebody that you paid, you trained for 5 years to do this job. Let's see what they need to keep them there. Let's figure this out.
Well, what's happening? Why are people leaving?
I think a lot of women leave because of isolation, for one. For years when I was in the business, I would be the only woman in a whole construction site. That's gotten a lot of better, but a lot of it is lack of opportunity to learn the craft. So men are like afraid, you know, to teach her, she probably just here for a paycheck. Different reasons. And a lot of it is because of they're not opening their eyes and seeing that she can do it just as good as you. Mm-hmm. And I think, and also, it's not, like I said, I think I've seen where men have a natural mentoring with each other. And with women, it's just not as easy to figure out, how can I take her under my wings and be a mentor? And I have become a really good plumber because men stepped up and said, you look like you want to do this, and I'm going to help you. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be, they didn't actually say I'm going to be a mentor, but they took me under their wing and showed me the craft, mm-hmm. and showed me how to love the craft and to excel at it. So if more men step up, more of our brothers step up and said, you know what, she's just like me, she could be my daughter, and look at it like, I am training somebody to help pay my pension. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, this is the person, these are people who are going to be paying my pension. So the more people we invest in, train, and they leave, is more dollars you're losing. So why not keep the people that already came and try to bring more people into this? Because the union is life-changing. Like I said, I was a housekeeper and nanny, grew up really poor in Trinidad, sleeping in the same bed with my grandmother. Nowhere else but America is my life possible. Like, this is amazing to come from where I was not growing up with a mother or father, and to be able to have a good union job with benefits, and, you know, it's like, this is what America is about.
Man, I love that last comment, Joe. And, you know, sometimes you have to turn, unfortunately, to a more recent immigrant to get that level of understanding. Like, this is what America is all about. This is what built this country. This is what makes it great.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of labor leaders out there that should take note and, you know, use that energy that's there.
I love it. So we're going to have to take a break there, but we will be right back in just a second with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer. This is Labor Press. And now back to your hosts, Neil Tappel and Bill Hohlfeld.
I'm just a working man, but I stay busy every day.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. I'm your host, Bill Hohlfeld. In the studio with me is my friend and colleague, Joe Maniscalco. Well, Joe, you know, I did. I love the way she capped off that interview. And I love her vigorousness and just her approach to life.
Judeline Cassidy, the Plumbers Union. She's an outstanding spokesperson, and she's very visible. She's been on network TV a few times in the last couple of weeks, and she's a great example of trade unionism.
Well, good for her. Lunch. Good for her, man. Now, and I know we got somebody really special coming up next. Am I right?
Yeah, we have an interview with our old friend Doug Cunningham from Workers Independent News that we did a little while ago. Unfortunately, November 17th was the last recording that Wins did.
I know.
But Doug is still fighting a good fight. He's still working with us, and we haven't heard from Doug, and There's an example of that.
All right, well, let's hear it right now.
Hey, Bill, Joe, good to be with you guys, man.
All right, so listen, so, you know, we have this little tradition that we've been doing about kind of doing an annual wrap-up here with the highlights of what's going on in the wonderful world of labor. So why don't you take it from the top and tell us what you see percolating these days?
Yeah, okay. I mean, lots of things out there, obviously. Labor's been involved nationally in a whole lot of different arenas. I mean, politics and organizing and collective bargaining issues and all sorts of things. And, you know, the year started off pretty positively, actually, with a couple of things. I mean, the postal workers have been fighting this privatization effort, and specifically Staples stores getting postal work farmed out to them, which cost some jobs in the Postal Service if it continued. So they were really against that, and that ended. They got that news in January of this year, so they were successful there, the American Postal Workers Union and the National Association of Letter Carriers as well. And some good news as well for the auto industry at the beginning of the year. I mean, the United Auto Workers had embraced some decisions that were made to invest money in U.S. plants. Fiat Chrysler announcing a decision to invest billions in Ohio and Michigan, and General Motors later announcing that it was doing a $1 billion investment. But, you know, there was a mixed bag here, obviously, as well, because the American Federation of Teachers, they weren't too happy with Betsy DeVos being named to head the Department of Education. And Andy Puzder had been nominated for Labor Secretary. He was an executive for Carl's Jr. and Hardee's stores. And
That was particularly scary.
Yeah, wasn't it, though? Yeah. Yeah. Who's going to be, you know, who's going to be your Secretary of Labor to look out for the interest of workers? Oh, a fast food exec, you know. Yeah, not exactly resonating with working people, you know.
Right.
So the good news is that his nomination was blocked, although another guy that wasn't too friendly with labor actually got in as well. So, you know, it started off that way, you know, and we had issues, too. Like, remember, a lot of workers voted for Trump, and they thought that he was going to champion their interests. Turned out, according to the AFL-CIO, not so much. But it started off again. There was a meeting in January, toward the end of January, with the building trades unions with Trump, right? And they announced, Trump announced he was going to build the Keystone Pipeline. He was going to greenlight that and get that going. So that was good.
Just sprang a leak recently.
Yeah, it did. But, I mean, it was good news for construction workers. I mean, building trades are looking out for jobs, and they thought there were going to be thousands of jobs in connection with this pipeline. So that was good. And he also reiterated his promise, though, for an infrastructure plan, right?
Right. And we were all in favor of that. That was a bipartisan deal, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I was down for that, too, but it didn't happen. It didn't happen, you know. And the American Society of Civil Engineers, and by the way, these are all stories I covered, okay? These are things that I covered over the year, too. American Society of Civil Engineers, they said that what America really needs when it comes to infrastructure, and who best know, you know, the engineers should know, if anybody, right? $4.6 trillion, they said, was really needed in infrastructure investments to really bring the U.S. up to par on that.
A lot of jobs.
Yeah, yeah. And they also said the failure to act, which so far there has been a failure to act, they said, would cost as many as 2.5 million jobs and $7 trillion in lost business by 2025. Now, that's the American Society of Civil Engineers. It shows you just how important and huge that infrastructure investment could be if the Trump administration moved on that.
Yeah, but Doug, it's hard to get a bunch of bridges built when you're busy, you know, trying to figure out how to get the biggest possible tax cut for corporations.
yeah, that's right. And of course, you know, they're still trying to do that. And every independent group that looks at that says one of the key aspects of the tax cut, most of the benefits are flowing to the rich, and most of the benefits that flow to the rich are going to be permanent. Any little tax breaks that the middle class or working class gets are going to phase out over time. And so by, you know, they're going to hurt people with making incomes of $30,000 to $40,000 a year. They're going to lose out. People making huge money, they're going to win. And it's the same old, same old. And working people have got to wake up about that. You know, I mean, when you just say in general, oh, tax cuts, well, that sounds good to a lot of people. But when you get into the details of it, you realize, number one, it's going to add to the deficit big time, over $1.5 trillion to the deficit. This is from Republicans who keep saying that they're concerned about the deficit. So, as always, when I covered labor news, I tried to look out for what was happening, how it was going to affect working people, and try to bring that to our audience about it, you know, just try to get people more informed about what was going to happen so they didn't just bite hook, line, and sinker on that generalization. Hey, let's cut taxes. Oh, yeah, let's go, you know.
Exactly. And, that dovetails exactly what we've been talking about here the last couple of weeks. And so important, like, if it's not us digging into the details of what's happening in the workplace, who's going to do it? It's not going to be the corporate media.
No, it's not. And that's one of the reasons that I've been doing what I've been doing all these years for 13 years, covering labor news nationally, trying to do it. This is news by workers, for workers, and telling the truth about the impact on workers. And I know politicians can have a good line. They can come up and they can sound really good. They can talk a really good line, you know, but they don't walk the walk. They just talk the talk, and then they get in and it's the same old, same old. And we don't need any more benefits flowing to the top 1%. They've got about half of all of the wealth in America as it is. And you know, even people like Warren Buffett, one of the richest men in the world, says the last thing that guys like him need is another tax cut. And so we've got to get real about these issues because our families are at stake. You know, it's our livelihoods, our communities.
And just like going back before we get too far away from it, back to the whole infrastructure issue, I mean, the Trump plan, when you looked at it, when you dug into the details, it was a giant giveaway where they actually wanted to sell off the freaking roads and everything else.
Yeah. And the Economic Policy Institute, among others, pointed out that it was a weak, fake plan, that it wasn't the real, substantial, immediate investment that we needed. And if that investment were to occur and government were to get involved in a serious way with that, you talk about construction jobs. My God, that would be fantastic for construction workers and working families all over the country. There'd be lots and lots of jobs created. And plus, after it's all done, we would have a modern infrastructure.
And you know, Doug, I think one of the things that people forget is when you create construction jobs, I mean, that has a serious multiplier effect. I mean, if you create a factory job, you create, and not that we shouldn't create them, please don't misunderstand me, but if you create a factory job, you create, you know, one job. If you create a construction job, all of a sudden people are bringing their lunch and buying work clothes and getting new pickup trucks to get back and forth to work. And you know, you create a lot more jobs. You probably create, if I'm not mistaken, three full-time jobs for every full-time construction job.
Yeah, that's right. And by the way, Bill, I mean, manufacturing jobs also have a multiplier effect. I mean, the auto industry in particular has a multiplier effect, you know, and that's what we got to understand, that when we advocate for working people or advocate for union jobs, we're not talking about just a special interest group. We're talking about something that if you did that, you would create multiplier effects throughout the economy. It would be good for the economy in general. And it's much better for our economy, believe it or not, to take the money away from the 1% and distribute it further down the income chain in America, because that money gets circulated in the economy. So it's a practical thing that we're talking about, not just a special interest or, you know, bowing to what unions want. This is something that's good for America.
Right. It's not a question of being altruistic, because as we heard also Julian said, it's like our country's falling apart. And we got to fix it.
Right. And those come from the engineers, and not the social engineers, the civil engineers.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. In the meantime, he wants to build a wall. Well, okay, if you're going to build a wall, all you're going to do is wall in our bad infrastructure. You know, that's how you got to build some bridges, too, while you're building walls, right?
Well, there you have it, Bill, the one and only Doug Cunningham. And I encourage everyone to keep listening to Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. Keep coming to our website, laborpress.org, to hear more from Doug, because he's definitely going to be involved. Right now, we're going to switch it back over to you, Bill, for your spotlight on American labor history.
Ah, thanks, Joe. On December 11th, 1886, the Colored Farmers Alliance was established in Lovelady, Texas. This was a brave attempt of black farmers to avoid tenancy and sharecropping. It came about because, sadly, the original Farmers Alliance, an organization formed to address the concerns of Southern farmers, refused to integrate. So, beginning in December of 1886, black organizations began forming under the name the Colored Farmers Alliance to argue for black rights within the larger alliance movement. Organizers moved across the South, organizing African Americans for higher crop prices, lower railroad rates, and other policies that would help sharecroppers. All small Southern farmers had problems in the late 19th century. Both races had common obstacles, such as crop liens and the inability to finance a crop without going into debt. Both also had similar goals, such as higher commodity prices and railroad regulation. The response of elite whites to the Colored Farmers Alliance was predictable. Race baiting undermined any alliance between whites and blacks. Still, by 1890, the CFA had 1.2 million members. Then, in 1891, it attempted to institute a strike to raise the price of cotton, which ended in a dismal failure. That was disastrous for sharecroppers, who made up a significant percentage of the membership of both alliances. Their organizations were the one possibility of fighting for policies that would help their lives, and their inability to work in concert led to their inevitable demise.
Thanks, Bill. That does it for another episode of Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. Don't forget, if you like us, follow us on Twitter at Labor Press NY. Write us at bcb@laborpress.org. Go to our website at laborpress.org or find us on Facebook. And don't forget to tune in to Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz next week here on AM 970 The Answer.